Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for October 18th, 2016. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Eric Howra about using network biology to identify potential targets for treating lung cancers that have increased activity of the tyrosine kinase ALK. Chromosomal rearrangements are common in cancer cells. These rearrangements can result in the loss of gene function, or they can splice two genes together so that the new sequence encodes a fusion protein that consists of parts of two proteins that are normally separate. In some cases of lung cancer, a chromosomal rearrangement causes the production of an EML4 ALK fusion protein. This chimeric protein has the N-terminus of EML4, which mediates homodimerization, fused to the intracellular kinase domain of ALK, which promotes cell survival. Inhibitors that target ALK are used clinically to treat patients with EML4 ALK-positive lung cancers, but the tumor cells often develop resistance to these inhibitors. To identify additional proteins that are important for EML4 ALK prosurvival signaling, a group led by Eric Howra looked at the signaling network downstream of ALK and found that knocking down many of these proteins sensitized ALK-rearranged lung cancer cells to ALK inhibitors. These findings offer a starting point for designing new drugs to use in combination with ALK inhibitors to improve the response to the ALK inhibitors, reduce tumor resistance, and improve clinical outcome. Howra spoke to me from the H. Lee Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Dr. Howra. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How common are EML4 ALK fusions in lung cancers? And what's the prognosis for patients that have these types of cancers?
These fusions occur in about 3 to 5% of patients with adenocarcinoma of the lung, which is the most common type. The prognosis really depends on the stage of the patient when they're diagnosed with their lung cancer, so that patients with early stage ALK-positive lung cancer can be cured with surgery or surgery combined with radiation or chemotherapy. But for patients with metastatic ALK-positive cancer, this is generally felt to be an incurable illness despite the strong progress that we've made in the last couple of years with targeted agent therapy.
Why is the particular chromosomal rearrangement that fuses EML4 to ALK so common?
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that. It seems to be that ALK preferentially fuses with proteins that allow it to dimerize and become an active signaling protein. But I think a lot more research needs to be done to identify why that occurs. And perhaps, although this is just speculation, these types of fusion events occur at some basal level during our lifetime in cells, and ALK part of the chromosome fuses with another part, and that enables a competitive advantage for that cell to ultimately become a tumor. But like I mentioned, it's rather speculative at this point.
What does normal ALK do in a cell?
What ALK does in mammalian cells or human cells still is rather unclear. In Drosophila, it seems to be important in helping brain metabolism during starvation, but the role in human signaling still is rather unclear. The study about a year or so ago found that the ligand for normal ALK is heparin, and hopefully those studies are going to give us a sense of what ALK is doing in normal cells.
The EML4 ALK fusion protein consists of the part of EML4 that mediates dimerization, stuck to the kinase domain of ALK. This juxtaposition causes constitutive activation of ALK. So ALK inhibitors are used clinically to treat lung cancers that have this EML4 ALK fusion. How effective are those inhibitors in treating disease?
These can be quite effective. So in patients that have bona fide ALK-rearranged lung cancer, response rates to small molecule ALK tyrosine kinase inhibitors can be 50 to 60%, meaning 50 to 60% of the patients will have strong tumor regressions. Equally important is that even in patients that have become resistant to some ALK inhibitors, so for example, resistance to crizotinib can still be overcome with second or third generation ALK tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And even in those patients that are resistant, response rates can be 50%. So there's two main limitations. One is that 50% response rate is great when you take care of people with advanced lung cancer, but it's not 100%. So what is driving intrinsic resistance to patients that harbor a ALK translocation? The second limitation is the nearly inevitable arise of acquired drug resistance to tyrosine kinase inhibitors, meaning patients can have a durable benefit to these drugs, but ultimately develop new tumor growth, which can be fatal in some cases. So there's really been a need to understand both primary resistance and acquired resistance and come up with new compounds and drug strategies that can overcome those two forms.
The EML4 ALK fusion causes constitutive activation of ALK and therefore also activation of the signaling network downstream of ALK. How did you identify downstream targets of ALK in lung cancer cells?
We took a systems proteomic approach to do this, and we did two basic experiments. The first is essentially tagging ALK and some key known signaling adapters that are involved in ALK signaling, and then expressing those tagged versions back into ALK-rearranged lung cancer cells, allowing them to interact with other proteins and then fishing them back out again. And then we use mass spectrometry as a way to identify proteins that are found in complex with those proteins. So we use that to create what we call an interactome, or a set of proteins that are interacting with ALK and critical adapter proteins. The second approach is to look at changes in phosphoproteins. And the way we've typically done this and done this for the paper is to use antibodies that enrich tyrosine phosphorylated peptides in ALK-positive cells and treated with ALK inhibitors to identify changes in the tyrosine phosphoproteome that is driven by ALK itself. And then we've combined those two data sets together, essentially derive a larger interactome or network that we think harbors the key proteins that are surrounding ALK and help modulate its activity.
You focused in particular on two of these proteins that are downstream of ALK. What are those proteins, and why did you focus on them?
Yeah, we focused on fibroblast growth factor response substrate 2 and coiled coil and C2 domain containing protein 1A. The latter is called CC2D1A. We've had an interest in adapter proteins and scaffold proteins for a couple of years, and those are proteins that are involved not in producing any catalytic activity, but are important in serving as larger scaffolds that can bring signaling molecules and substrates together, or adapters that can couple receptors to other key intracellular signaling pathways. And both FRS2 and CC2D1A are both proteins in that class, and we thought that they would be interesting to study because they've really not had a lot of attention in terms of thinking about how those proteins are involved in affecting drug sensitivity.
You identified a total of 68 proteins that, when lost, sensitized cells to ALK inhibitors. Are all of these potential targets for developing drugs that could be used in combination with ALK inhibitors?
Yes, I would say they're all potential candidates for developing drugs, but they have different, I would say, ease of how easy it could be to develop drugs against some of these targets. So in some cases, we found enzymes like FAK, which there already exist FAK inhibitors, and then those can be used. We found two protein tyrosine phosphatases, which, since they have catalytic activity, could be potential drug targets, although there are challenges for creating drugs against phosphatases. We do find a lot of these scaffold proteins and adapter proteins, and this has been a more difficult area for chemists to develop drugs against. They tend to lack these classic binding pockets where, say, one can create small molecule kinase inhibitor mimetics. But that said, there are a number of groups now that are looking to create compounds that disrupt protein-protein interactions, and this could be important in disrupting adapter or scaffold interactions with signaling proteins or substrates. And then there's also some interesting reports using different types of chemistry that can disrupt proteins that lack catalytic activity. So, you know, I think the potential is there. It won't be without challenges, but there certainly are a number of candidates in here that could be considered.
Thanks, Eric, for speaking with us.
Okay, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That was Eric Howra discussing a paper published in the October 18th issue of Science Signaling by Zhang and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.